All right, good afternoon. It's 10 minutes past 1. We're on the record. We have three pieces of legislation before us. We have two wayward travelers amongst us, Representative Gruenberg and Representative Aaron, who were previously excused and who are back with us. In addition is Representative Lynn, Representative Gatto.
Song is over, but the melody lingers on.
Yeah, it keeps replaying over and over until you unplug the jukebox. Representative Dahlstrom and Representative Rammers. So we're on the record. So it's my fourth year, so it's just impulse purchase. We're coming back from lunch at Olivia's, the notorious site of the $50
appetizer.
Mm-hmm. And so on the way back, we were looking at these beautiful plants, and so that we maintain this on the record. Bless you. They're for Susan Rial for doing such a great job. Please spell the name. So these are for you, Susan. And you have to change the water every 2 weeks, and you have to use bottled water, and then trim the roots every 2 months.
Oh, wow.
So nice, and they'll fit right on your little desk. So I went for the tall vertical so they could stay on your desk to the end of session perfectly.
That's really nice.
Yes. So that's from a grateful committee. It's called it's the name of the plant at the plant store by Olivia's. That you go in there and they'll give you great instructions on care. And so you're welcome, because we like you a lot. You've done an exceptional job and you have a great disposition. So here's to Susan. All right, so here's to my boiler man, Rocky Pavey, who should be joining us telephonically for House Bill 253. Rocky, I'm going to have you stand by wherever you are calling from. This is House Bill 253. It is our first piece of business. Don Heberger is going to present the bill for us, and then I will make some remarks after Don has, and then we will take public testimony. And I will, this bill is maligned by some, and some of the lobbyists are beginning to work against it on behalf of the banking industry. But frankly, I love the working man. And so we're going to take some testimony, and I'm going to at least articulate a concern for you. Don?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Don Heberger, and I work for Representative Jay Rammers, District 10. So I'm here to talk to you this afternoon about House Bill 253, the Mechanics Material Man Lien Bill. In our office nomenclature, we have called this the Rocky Bill. Why would we so tag House Bill 253? Simple. A number of hardworking men and women running small businesses in Fairbanks asked for a change in state law to help them better serve their customers and their community. So this is a ground-up piece of legislation, as all legislation should be. What does Rocky's bill do? Simply, it extends by 30 days in state law the time in which a mechanic or material man may work with a customer in payment or settlement of a bill or an invoice before they are forced to file a lien. So instead of 90 days in current law, it simply changes it to 120 days. I cannot speak as eloquently as Rocky can about the need for this particular piece of legislation and some of the challenges that they face as they deal with a customer base, particularly in our economic cycle we're in. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to close my testimony.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Don. Are there any questions for Don? And then I have more wayward travelers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
You want to go from 90 to 120 days. Can I make an amendment that would make the legislative session?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So point well made. So the purpose of this piece of legislation is for those folks that still live in a diesel community. When you live in a diesel community, and this extends to other trades, just more than just boilers, But when you live in a diesel community, sometimes your boiler goes on the fritz, you know. The harder it works, the more inclined it is to go out. And so, you know, Murphy's law at work, rarely does your boiler go out from 9 to 5. Usually it's nights and weekends and holidays and cold weather.
50 below.
Yes, 50 below. And so if a boiler man shows up at, you know, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock or midnight, you're so grateful to have him do the work. And then when the bill comes, sometimes it's easy for them to get shuffled to the bottom of the pile. Furthermore, in cold communities where you have boilers, sometimes the boiler goes on the fritz or you have water damage. You're working with insurance companies. It takes a long time to resolve the insurance claim, and a check can be made out to the occupant, and then they don't pay the person who does the work. And so this is an effort to attempt to address this. And I had the home builders in my room, and the home builders, particularly those in Anchorage, are opposed to this piece of legislation. And they believe that you ought to be able to present a waiver of the right, a waiver of lien. I'm not sure what the exact document is, the name of the exact document. But what they want you to do is to secure a promise from the person that you're doing work for that they'll be you're immediately suspect of whether they're good pay at the moment that you do work for them. And I would be offended if my boiler man presented me a document and suspected me of being a good pay if I have a regular relationship with him. So I'm interested in doing this on behalf of those communities that are really lagging behind natural gas communities. And so with that, Rocky, I probably didn't say it as eloquently as you. We have four people that wish to testify. They're all in Fairbanks. Rocky Pavey with Rocky's Heating. Grace Rudy with Overhead Door Company, which is a different kind of entity, and we do have that franchise, I think, across the state. Wayne Long with Wayne's Air Supply, and Jim Slater with Slater Construction. We're going to take testimony from all four and anybody in the room who cares to testify, and then see what the will of the committee is. Rocky, are you with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And for those in the committee, should know that just in the interest of full disclosure, that I've known Rocky since I was 14. He is far and away, although Lathrop High School was constructed in the 1950s, Rocky Pavey is a Hall of Fame quarterback at Lathrop High School, clearly the best quarterback that Lathrop High School ever had. Why he was not drafted by Division I college and didn't go on to play in the NFL is utterly beyond me, but he has opted to stay in the community of Fairbanks, and he enriches it culturally. And he's one of the finest people. He's one of the finest. He and his wife, Catherine, are two of the finest people that I know. And I'm honored to have you come before my committee. So with that, Lefty, if you want to offer your testimony, we're grateful to hear from you.
Eloquent words indeed. And I may have been the finest quarterback, but only the second best athlete Lathrop has ever produced, because that first honor would go to Mr. Ramirez, the perhaps the best 98-pound wrestler in the state, whose exploits are still legendary in the halls of Lathrop High School. With that being said, Chairman Ramos, I appreciate your and the other committee members' time today to hear this bill that is very near and dear to several small business owners' hearts, not just in Fairbanks, but I would suspect across the state of Alaska. As you all know, small business is the economic backbone of any community, and I would feel that this bill would help the small business men and women here across the state in securing the payment of their hard work. The intent of this is to extend the amount of time necessary or allowed us to lien a customer by an additional 30 days. And the reason that I feel that is important is it's strictly a timing issue. If we were to do work for a customer at the beginning of the month, the statement for that work is not generated to the end of that month, so we're now out 30 days from the initial time of servicing. As most of you are probably familiar with, once you receive a bill in the mail, oftentimes you feel you have 30 days to pay that bill. So now we are at 60 days before we really can even expect to see payment from a multitude of our customers. Oh. If for some reason that customer calls us and says, Rocky, you know, I blew the motor in my truck. I just don't have the money this month. Or, you know, we had some medical bills show up. I just can't pay this month. Can I pay you next month? As most of these customers are long-term customers of ours, we extend that courtesy to our customers to not create an adversarial relationship and to, you know, help out honest, hardworking folks. However, that should not be done at our own peril. If we were to wait until the next month to receive payment, we now have to make a judgment call. Will this person in fact pay us at the next payment cycle, or is it going to be push us past the 90-day cycle? And so often in around 75 to 85 days, we are forced to make a judgment call. Do we lien this person to protect our interest, thereby creating an adversarial relationship with a long-term good customer, and do so at our own peril, or do we extend that out and just hope, cross our fingers and hope that they will indeed pay us after the 90-day lien has expired, or you know the 90-day period that we have to file our lien. By extending this out to 120 days, I can see it really as a win-win situation, not only for the contractor, but for the homeowner as well. After that 90-day period has expired, we would know within another 10 or 15 days whether that customer is in fact going to pay us or not. So it allows us the courtesy to extend better payment terms to our customers without having to file a lien and creating an adversarial relationship and also damaging the credit report or the credit history of our customers. The working men and women of small business here, even though it has been raised by the Home Builders Association, that we have the ability to file a notice of intent to lien that does not necessarily work in a service industry so much as it does perhaps a new home construction where you're only dealing with one or two customers maybe once or twice a month. It would be easy to file that notice of right to lien. However, as Mr. Ramirez said earlier in his testimony, in the middle of the night, it's very difficult to present a customer whose home is rapidly falling in temperature, who is on the verge of freezing up. It's hard to oftentimes get these customers to sign something at that moment. And oftentimes, in our particular situation, we deal with absentee landlords, where we're working on a building where the landlord, the owner of the property, is physically not present. A business whose business is the owner is not at the business. Or homeowners who just may be at work and are unable to meet us there at their home, it really is quite impractical to assume that we can file one of these notice of right to lien papers every single service call. We run in the middle of wintertime when it's very cold up here, we can run upwards of 20 service calls a day, and to expect my technicians to track down the owners would just create a massive nightmare of paperwork trying to track down the owners to get them to sign this notice of right to lien. I find it to be probably very unnecessary if this bill could be extended out to 120 days. It would allow us, again, the opportunity to extend grace to those customers who are maybe just having a hard time that particular month meeting a bill, and yet not put our own businesses and economic livelihood in peril by not leaning and taking the chance. I personally, through my company, have lost tens of thousands of dollars, approaching probably close to even hundreds of thousands of dollars, in being taken advantage of by unscrupulous people who, quite frankly, work this to their advantage, knowing the full circumstances that we only have 90 days to lien. As a business owner, I just feel it would be better for us to allow our customers that extra time needed to pay the bill, and it would weed out those customers who are truly struggling just in a particular month but have every intent to pay their bill. It would weed those honest, hardworking people out from those people who are, quite frankly, just working the system. And there are those folks out there who know how to work the system to take advantage of our courtesy and of our grace period. We unfortunately do not have the option, much like an automobile repair shop or some other place where you bring your equipment into them. We cannot hold your equipment hostage until you pay us. We are there. The boiler is installed in your home. We actually, when we leave that home without payment, we really have no assurance that we're going to get paid. We can't very well go remove that boiler out of their home once the work has been done. And so I thank Mr. Ramirez for his bringing this bill to the forefront on my behalf and other hardworking businessmen here in Fairbanks in the state. And I would highly encourage the committee there to please give careful consideration to this as a way to help the small businessmen and women out, not only in Fairbanks, but throughout the rest of the state.
Rocky, thank you. And just to correct the record, I was the worst wrestler in the state of Alaska. In 1981, I lost every match.
But that's not my recollection.
But I did beat out Billy Weiss, the deaf kid, for most inspirational, which was hard to do because Billy was great.
I ran across Billy a couple of days ago on a furnace job, as a matter of fact, and he is still a very great man.
He is a great man, and he is a fun wrestler. And So, Representative Gatto has a question for you, Rocky.
Yes.
Yeah, Rocky, are any of your clients opposed to this bill?
Quite frankly, I don't know the answer to that. Just my gut feeling is I really don't see how it would negatively affect them by us giving them extra time to pay their bill without having to lien them and file and tarnish their credit history. I really see it as a win-win situation.
And second question, are any of your colleagues that do similar types of work, whether it's automotive or plumbing or electrical, opposed to the bill?
Absolutely not. Just quite the contrary. In fact, I have spoken with several other shops, and unfortunately, they are not here today. It is rather cool in Fairbanks, and a lot of my fellow furnace men are out actually working today. But every single person that I've talked to, every single one, has been absolutely enthusiastic in support of this. They see it as a way to protect their interests and also a way to protect their customers' interests.
And last question. What if it wasn't 120? What if it was 180? Would you still be in favor of it, or is 120 pretty much the ideal number?
Well, 120 would allow us that extra 10 or 15 days necessary because, you know, if somebody misses a payment 1 month, that's acceptable. If it's 2 months, I pretty much know that I need to protect myself. So, it's a matter of timing that, if they only miss 1 month, if they call me up and they say, you know what, I just can't make this month, I'll catch you next month. Unfortunately, next month puts me literally right at 90 days and I have to make a quick judgment call. If I had just an extra 30 days, that would pretty much allow me to weed out those folks who are not going to be able to pay versus those who will be able to pay, on their next paycheck. Really, the 30 extra days is really all that we need. 180 would be great. Make no mistake about it. The longer that we have to work with our customer, the better. But at a bare minimum, the 120 days would probably be sufficient.
Thank you, Rocky. And our friend Ashley Reed, the lobbyist, is against this bill, as is the banking industry. I got a call this morning, and that's the an offset is the bankers don't want anybody standing in front of their in front of their lien. Just to give you a sense of where some of the opposition comes from. On the other hand. A service call, Rocky, we've got some other trades here, but so a service call for a boiler tune-up, I think it's about $135, I think. But if I have an emergency call because my boiler's not working, nothing terrible is wrong, but you got to come out and tinker with it. It's after hours. What's the bill, $300, $350, something like that, by the time I pay a call out and an after-hours charge?
Well, actually, the pricing structure is a little bit different than that. Our normal tune-up fee is $325. That allows up to an hour and a half of labor and some associated miscellaneous parts. That is our standard scheduled rate for an annual servicing of your furnace. Again, those folks in Anchorage who are used to gas, that may seem exorbitant, but gas boilers and furnaces are much less labor-intensive than what oil-fired equipment is, and so there's much more cleaning that has to be done with the oil. So the amount of time and effort required for an oil-fired appliance is much higher, so our standard rate is $325 for annual servicing. If you were to call after hours, there's an additional $50 call-out fee on top of that, and so you're looking at a minimum of $375 to show up at your house after normal working hours.
Right. Okay, very good. Thank you. Are there any other questions? I don't see any, Rocky, so we appreciate if you just stand by for me, please. Next is Grace Rudy. In Fairbanks, also with Overhead Door Company. Grace, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
If you'll introduce yourself for the record and the company that you're affiliated with.
Grace Rudy, Overhead Door Company of Fairbanks.
Welcome. We're so happy to hear from you.
Thank you. I agree with everything that Rocky said. I don't think it can be said any better or any more thoroughly. The 120 days would definitely give you that chance to weed out the people that are really trying to pay their bills and the people that have no intention of paying them from the moment they call you. And it would be advantageous to the businesses and the customers. I can't really think of anything that he left out.
Succinctly said. I appreciate that. Are there any questions for Grace? And Grace, would you just give us a description of the kind of activities that you would are talking about and the range of bills that would be generated, the type of work that you would do that would be subjected to this that isn't new construction?
Whether it's new construction or existing construction, we have kind of the same type of after-hours call-outs. We get calls in the middle of the night year-round. When somebody's overhead door is stuck open, it can either be an issue for the house freezing up in the wintertime or in the summertime just a security issue. And we get lots of after-hours calls also, and where you don't know sometimes who the owner of the building is, you don't really have an opportunity to get a lot of information about the customer, and you really are just going out there in good faith and trusting that hopefully they will pay the bill. And for our company, during normal hours, we charge $120 an hour, and after hours is $180. And we charge for travel, so a service call is going to be a minimum of $120, and it can go up from there.
And how many people do you employ at Overhead Door Company?
We have an average of 13 employees.
And would you just lean over and ask Rocky how many people he employs at Rocky's Heating?
16, he said.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Grace? Mm-hmm. And next is Wayne Long with Wayne's Air Supply. Wayne?
How you doing?
Good. Introduce yourself and your company for the record.
I'm Wayne Long, Wayne's Air Supply, and I'm just a one-man shop. I work by myself, and I just agree with these guys, what they said. Having extra the extra days would be helpful. I'm working with the insurance company right now that owes us $5,000, and it's getting close. And so, you know, they could take their time not, you know, paying. But if we had the power to put the extra lien on when we need to do it, it'd be nice to, you know, have that availability.
And
thank you very much.
Thank you, Wayne. If you'll just clarify, it's not the insurance company that would default. It's the homeowner to whom the check will be made out to. The insurance company makes out the check to the homeowner, and then you have to rely on the homeowner to pay you. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right.
So can you go ahead and explain that so we can pick that up in testimony?
Well, the work has already been done, and so the claim has already been made, and so they say that the insurance company says the check's in the mail, and we call the homeowner, and, you know, we get a different story. So, you know, by the timing, like Rocky says, if it's close to 90 days or 90 days, and it's after 90 days and we don't have any activity, we can put a lien on the house, knowing that something is not right. You know, either the homeowner kept the money or, you know, is trying to deceive us. But we want to be fair and just, and, you know, we don't want, like Robbie says, we don't want to ruin people's credit, but we like to have the extra time to make the decision.
Very good. Any questions for Wayne? I don't see any questions, Wayne. I appreciate your testimony very much. And next is Jim Slater of Slater Construction. Jim, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, Jim Slater with Slater Construction here in Fairbanks.
Welcome, Jim, and offer your testimony, please.
I think that the time frame, even if you expand it, it could be more beneficial. I've been involved in a number of issues where I've had to put liens on people's property, more of kind of implied threat to pay, or, you know, litigation pursues that, you know, or precedes it or something of that nature. Also, on the other hand, I've had a vendor that I had done some work at concrete company that I had used them as a supplier for the concrete. The business owner was way late in paying. He was actually over a year and finally paying his bill, but because of the lien laws, they had 90 days to file a lien against myself or against the it should have been against the property owner. So I had to come up with the capital to pay them. Had they had a little bit more time, it would have saved some court services, paperwork processes and stuff, which, again, is expensive in so doing. I think that the 120 days for what the small repair people would be fine, but as a contractor, it's probably the longer length it would be better. I think it would limit or minimize some issues that are that I've experienced anyway with people not paying their bill. If they can't pay their bill, we're working on a cash flow situation, and I can't pay their bill, I don't have the ability to do that. Well, I'm sitting in the position where they're filing liens against my projects or something of that nature also. It puts the homeowner, the subcontractors, and the suppliers all at a disadvantage with that 90-day time frame. If it would be added another 30 days or even the 180 days would be better. I think it would be more advantageous for everybody. In my opinion, if you have to file a lien against somebody, there's issues as much as payment. I think there's honesty and credibility issues also involved in it. But if you had an extended period of time that you're not locked into the 90 days, it would be beneficial to everybody, I believe.
We are. Hey, Jim, how many people do you employ at Slater Construction, and what is, just give us a little profile of the kind of work you do there.
I'm a general contractor, and I sub out a lot of my work, or I'm working on my own. When I get involved in doing, say if I'm doing concrete, a slab or something for a particular business I do the slab for, there was probably about a $10,000 concrete bill, and I had a subcontractor that came and did the work. I paid the labor on it, but again, I'm robbing Peter to pay Paul on the materials. It puts you at a big disadvantage in a cash flow situation, and you don't want to alienate people you're working for, trying to keep a good reputation, but it's difficult sometimes when you have projects going on, and as Rocky is or other people in the service industry, you're looking, you know, probably bills at, you know, $1,000 or less, but in my situation, my bills are $10,000 or more. Extending the time frame would be great, but I think even the lien issues, it should be reviewed. The fact that you have that time frame, that 90-day time frame, you have to file litigation, but as I made Rocky aware of now, if you file litigation, it does not go to a small claims issue because it's involving property, deeds of trust. That's a superior court issue. Now your time frame to even get a court date typically is a year to a year and a half away because of the amount of cases here in Fairbanks.
Very good. I appreciate your testimony. Is there anybody else at the table who has any questions for any of our folks?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate listening to the testimony, what I've heard, that this will actually make it easier for homeowners because, and for you folks too in the industry, because everybody avoids additional legal fees. I think, and frankly, that's a benefit of this.
I agree, and I spoke to Rocky about this. In fact, Rocky, I mailed you the brochure from the Alaska Home Builders, who actually have this bill on their hit list as something that they oppose, just to make you and the other folks in the LIO and Fairbanks aware of this, that it's being opposed by the Alaska Home Builders Association, whom we were all visited by just a couple of days ago. And I explained to them, and you know, there is a benefit at this committee table, just to give you a little institutional benefit. When Representative Coghill left our body to go to the Senate, Representative Herron, who is with the community of Bethel and the surrounding areas, approached me about coming on the Judiciary Committee, and he was welcomed not only because he's a highly respected member of the legislature, but also because he represents rural Alaska, which has a different point of view often than urban Alaska does. And to that end, those of us that choose to live in a diesel community rather than a natural gas community face different kind of maladies, and this notion of after-hour call-outs, although it's relevant to overhead door, and we see some peripheral damage done to Wayne's Air Supply and the work that that he does, or to a general contractor, there also is this issue of late-night call-outs just to keep your home warm. And then once it's warm, then you fall under the tension of, well, do I pay my fuel bill, or do I pay to keep my furnace running? And since your furnace was fixed 60 days ago and your fuel bill is necessary in order to keep keep the fuel coming to keep your home warm, you can see the strain that it can create for a homeowner who is stretched as oil goes to 80-some dollars a barrel, and the price of home heating oil starts to top out at the $3 per gallon heating oil amount, which for my friends in South Central would be the equivalent of about $20 or $21 per MCF, because an MCF per dollar is 14 cents. I think it's 14.3 cents. So my last price, which was when oil was in the 70s, it was $2.81 a gallon. Now, oil has now above $80 a barrel again, and there is a relationship, and so probably closer to $3 a gallon for home heating oil. My home took 350 gallons of home heating oil. When I get a fill, I get a fill each month.
That's two donuts.
Two donuts. I brought a plant, so I brought a plant for Susan. So I'm gonna lay the donuts off onto Susan.
Oh no, not fair.
No, I'm just joking. Joking. No, I'm just. It's my donuts. So at $3 a gallon times 350 gallons, you can see it's $1,050 just to heat your home in a 30-day period. And, you know, and that happens to be the soapbox that I get on for being a member of a diesel community. But as we heard from Overhead Door and Wayne's Air Supply from a general contractor, these problems persist in other industries. And for the folks that are at the LIO in Fairbanks, I appreciate you taking time out of your day to come testify. Testimony from constituents and from the public really helps to define an issue for people sitting around a legislative table. This bill, as you know, went to the Labor and Commerce Committee first. It now it resides in the Judiciary Committee. Because it does not generate a fiscal note for the state of Alaska, it does not have a Finance Committee referral, which means that it will go from this committee through the Rules Committee, and we'll get scheduled for the floor. And the rules chair is the vice chair of this committee, so she will no doubt be subject to some lobby pressure, which is what we go through. And we respect the committee process here, so my job as the sponsor will be to try to agitate to get this bill to the floor, and the rules chair will make that judgment. Otherwise, this bill will go to the floor and to be scheduled, and then I will see whether we have the votes to pass it on the floor, and then it would go over to the Senate side. So that would be the civics lesson for you sitting at home in Fairbanks today, and I'm delighted to share the process with you. And it's deeply meaningful to have my lifelong friend Rocky Pavey there, and some of the other small business people in my community. As I added up, there's about, I don't know, about 50 or 60 jobs there that are dependent on getting paid in a timely fashion, and that's the way we build economies in communities in Alaska.
Just want to thank the committee for hearing this morning or this afternoon. It's you're right. It's very meaningful for the hardworking small business owners here, not just in Fairbanks but throughout the state. And again, this is not just a bill to help plumbing and heating companies, but any repair shop that is dependent upon the cash flow that is the lifeblood of any small business. It just gives us one more bullet in our gun to protect the interests of our companies. And as you so stated, small business is the economic engine that drives many of our local communities. You know, there are 16 families that make their living and livelihood off of Rocky's heating service. And being able to protect the financial well-being of our company directly impacts the advantage or the ability of 16 local families to provide for their families. And so it's not just to protect our interest, but also the interest of our long-term customers, who are oftentimes our friends, as Jay is, business owners. It just helps all the way around. I truly see it as a win-win situation for the contractor and the customer. And I appreciate you all hearing this testimony this afternoon, and very much appreciate Representative Ramirez taking the lead on this. Thank you all very much.
Yeah, that would be Mr. Chairman. Hello?
Mr. Chairman, 98-pound stud. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Rocky, I miss you. We appreciate that. Representative Gatto has a question for you. And, Rocky, if you will, you and others, if you will introduce yourself before you offer your testimony so that the Secretary can keep what you say straight for the log, please. Representative Gatto?
Actually, it's a question for the Chair.
Sure.
Could this be done by borough ordinance or
No, I don't believe so, Representative Gatto. I think this is Alaska statute, so this isn't unique to a borough. This is, in fact, Alaska statute. And I believe that if we went to other communities, we would find that this is a similar issue. It's just it's a boutique bill right now, but I think it has meaning across the state for anybody who has a repair shop that does home repairs and generally doesn't have the legal team to look out for their interests. The smaller the shop, the more subject you are to the good faith of the customer that you serve. Is really the gist of it. It's a little bit like when we took up that Harry Crawford's alcohol bill, and Brown Jug has a lawyer on retainer, so they can go out and get the clerk. You know, they can go out and collect people, the $1,000 people that that use a false ID or a fake ID. But when you get the smaller the business, the less you have access to our legal system, because the cost and the time is and this protects small contractors without them having to use the legal system, but allows them extra time for slow pays rather than no pays. And I think that's what we're trying to draw the distinction, is that at 90 days you may still be a slow pay, but the way they have to posture themselves is that in 90 days they have to make the decision that the customer they're dealing with is a no pay. Is that a good representation, Rocky?
Yes. Again, it's Rocky with Rocky's Heating. That's absolutely dead spot on, Mr. Chairman.
Nice. I felt respected by yourselves.
Thank you. Thank you, Poncho.
Rocky, do you realize we have to put up with this all the time?
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Fairbanks's gain is, you know, his loss or something like that. I'm not quite for sure. That was said with tongue firmly planted in cheek. Yeah. We missed Jay here.
Yeah. Better stop now. Representative Gatto, go ahead.
Just a clarification. It won't affect how I vote on this, but ordinances can make statutes more restrictive. So if this was 150 days, could an ordinance bring it down to 120 days and still be legitimate? I guess Representative Gruenberg might actually have that answer.
I'm sorry, I was passing a note, which I shouldn't have done. I learned that in school.
Should not have done. I agree with you on that. Since while I was speaking, you were passing a note. Here it is. Can an ordinance make a statute more restrictive, such that if we had in statute 180 days, could we go to Fairbanks and make it 90 or 120 days?
Through the chair, the answer is no.
So either way is illegal.
Right.
Thank you.
Now, that's because of the way this is written. In some circumstances, the answer would be yes. For example, in the field of tax exemptions, some of them are optional. And in order to even give the municipality the right to have a tax exemption, there has to be an amendment to Title 28, I believe, or whatever the Title 29.
Thank you.
That's because that's the way that's set up. This says, now says 90. If it said 120, the field is what we call preempted by state law.
Very good. So with that, is there anybody else that wishes to testify offline? Seeing none, is there anybody here in the room who wishes to offer testimony? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. We'll bring the bill back before the committee. Is there any discussion or amendments, Representative Herron?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. Passage of this bill will benefit the small businesses that I own in Bethel.
Object. You have to vote.
I'm not asking to.
Then I don't object.
Any other comments here at the table? Thank you. The chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill number 25326-LS0940/A with attached zero physical note and individual recommendations from committee.
Thank you. And so without objection, this bill will move from the Judiciary Committee. And folks back there in Fairbanks, you know, we seem to have two ways that we pass laws back here in Juneau. One is from the top down, which in my opinion would be President Obama's health care plan. And the other way we pass laws is from the bottom up, where folks and concerned citizens or small businesses decide that we need to make a change. And I'm much more comfortable with passing laws from the bottom up when individuals say we need to have a change to protect our families, our businesses, our communities, and so I see this as a bottom-up bill. It's my favorite kind of bill to hear in this committee, and I will be proud if the opportunity presents itself to carry this on the House floor, albeit even with an uncertain outcome. And we thank you very much for taking time out of your day to testify, and I look forward to seeing you all in Fairbanks. And thank you to Rocky, Grace, Wayne, and Jim, and the other folks that you've spoken to that you represent. And we appreciate it very much. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you all very much.
Representative Wilson and I had a wonderful conversation a couple days ago, and then earlier this morning. And she's going to find a very empathetic chairman to House Joint Resolution 38, which is the part of the same discussion, which is how many people do we represent, and how far do you have to travel to represent them. And Representative Wilson, you travel a lot of miles to represent 16,000 people, and we are happy to have you here at our committee table. If you'll introduce yourself for the record and present your piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Representative Peggy Wilson, District 2, and which is in Southeast Alaska. This bill, House Joint Resolution 38, will put a constitutional amendment before the voters in 2010, this November in the general election, and that would increase the size of the legislature to 44 representatives and 22 senators. If the initiative passes, the measure would apply to the 2012 redistricting effort. Alaska has not changed the 20 senators and 40 representatives size of its legislative body since becoming a state 50 years ago. We are the smallest bicameral legislature in the nation. In the past 50 years, Alaska's population has more than tripled. The large urban areas have grown very fast, while the rural and the small communities have stayed flat or decreased. It's becoming more difficult and contentious to comply with Article 6, Section 4 of our Constitution, and I quote, "Each House district shall be formed of contiguous and compact territories containing as nearly as practical a relatively integrated social economic area." Now, except for the 1960 reapportionment, all reapportionments have been settled in the courts. In other words, every single time there's been a census, and then we followed with a reapportionment of our districts, it has gone to court every single time except that first time. Each time the reapportionment has been challenged, it has lost, resulting in boundary adjustments, and on several occasions the courts has actually redrawn the lines themselves. Federal protection of the U.S. Voters' Rights Act of 1965 for large minority concentrations further complicate Alaska's reapportionment process. They can even act to counter Section 4 of the Alaska State Constitution requirements. Rural election district distortions are evident even in our current plan. There is a probability that the new population distribution of the 2010 census cannot reconcile the Section 6 and the Voters' Rights Act without increasing the size of the legislature. So it's possible that it's impossible to do without this increase. Between 1960 and 2006, 29 states have changed their size of their bodies. For the 9 states with small populations similar to ours, the average size of their legislative bodies is 134 members. Ours is 60. Not only has the number of voters for each legislator represents tripled, so has the complexity of the fiscal responsibilities that we each have. In 1961, the government programs and projects of the Alaska legislature was responsible for, and this is hard for me to even believe that it was this small, $104 million. In 10, it is approximately $7 billion. This is an increase from $2,700 per capita to the present time of $10,000 per capita today. This change in the size of the legislature will give Alaskans that reside in ever-expanding rural districts better access to their legislators. Rural residents will never have the ease of access urban dwellers have, but an increase in the size of the legislature may keep the access similar to what it is now. For these reasons, I am asking the members of this committee to pass this resolution out of committee so that we can get this initiative to increase the size of the legislature before the voters in 2010. Mr. Chairman, we have representatives. Madam Chairman, we have representatives here from the department to speak on the fiscal note, and Tam Cook from Ledge Legal and Margaret Payton Walsh from the AG's office are online for any of your legal questions. And I want to thank everyone for allowing me to present this to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. I know there is a question from Representative Perrin for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wilson is, you know, obviously I have a particular interest in this proposed resolution, but I'll ask you a couple of questions. But first is, I have a sister-in-law that doesn't like the phrase devil's advocate, so let me take the position of the angel's advocate then. Is okay, so the urban areas it's obvious that urban areas are going to gain members because of the population. So under this plan, they would still gain, and then the other less populated areas of the state would at least maintain for at least another 10 years. The question is there's some would say that that's still a dilution of power distribution in the state. So who is going to promote the passage of this constitutional amendment when, in my mind, the urban areas, the people that live there, will say, so? Why should we be concerned about there being more representation in the bush?
Well, for one thing, I think you have in front of you a map.
Yes.
And the yellow part of this is only one senator's district. And I think that will explain to you, for one thing, how impossible it has grown to in the past for some districts to represent and know their people. And if we do nothing, this district will get much larger. And the other districts will be much more condensed, of course, in the urban areas. So it also breaks down to a fairness issue as far as is it fair to the legislator that represents those people, and is it fair to the people that they have a legislator that is so spread out? This district is the biggest district in the whole United States. And there comes a point where you don't want them to keep getting bigger. But there is someone online that probably could answer that better than I.
Madam Chair, I guess a follow-up is that, yes, Representative Wilson, I mean, I understand that, but and you and I probably appreciate it more than our colleagues, constituents. I'm not talking about our colleagues. I'm talking about the average person on the street. For example, when you drive in any part of Anchorage, and I'm talking about Anchorage, I'm not talking about out the highway and where things are spread out a little bit more, but why would a person that's not I'm not talking about legislators, but why would a constituent be concerned about the size of a state when, you know, because of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, it's not based upon areas like it used to be for nine western states. It's based upon one person, one vote. So, again, other than rural areas, who would advocate in urban areas to maintain a certain number of legislators in rural areas? I mean, who's going to advocate for us besides ourselves.
Well, it probably will happen the same way it has always happened in the past. It'll go to the courts, and the courts will decide, and as in the past.
As to the, but I'm speaking to the resolution, the ballot measure for the resolution. That's, I'm not speaking about redistricting.
Madam Chair, maybe I can answer the question.
Yeah. Representative Grover?
I think this bill has tremendous beneficial impact in cities. And Representative Dahlstrom and I are prime examples of that. She represents a district that's almost entirely the basis. I represent Mountain View, that's a very distinct area socioeconomically, and Russian Jack to a certain extent, the same way. It will allow us to keep our district small and cohesive as a group in a socioeconomic area, just as much as Representative Herron, who represents a lot of people who have the same heritage, the same language, the same economy. And it's quite different than the interior in many cases, as I understand it.
The heritage and language of Mountain View is different than, is that what you mean?
They're all different than you.
Bethel.
and actually, we can, we are. That's very true. We have a very much of a gateway community, much like New York City at the turn of the century, with many immigrants and much the same problems and needs, the integration, assimilation, crime and stuff. And I think that to get this passed, if enough people in the legislature put it on the ballot, it will be essential to get a group of urban people with you folks. So it's not, and I would not have characterized it particularly as a rural bill. It may have the effect of allowing you to retain a seat or two. But the real thing that it's going to do is keep our district small. Alaska has a heritage and a history of knowing our constituents and knowing our legislators. Where else can you walk down the street and everybody knows the U.S. senators?
Madam Chair, and then Representative Ramirez, while you're out of the room, I have a sister-in-law that hates the phrase devil's advocate, so she likes to call it angel's advocate, and so my question is, as an angel's advocate question, is I support the resolution, but my question that I believe still has not been answered is, who is going to advocate besides my constituents and Representative Wilson's constituents for this? Because I believe that my colleagues who understand, why would their constituents vote to maintain rural representation? My question: who is going to advocate besides Representative Wilson's constituents and my constituents on this ballot measure?
Representative Herron, I want to alert you that the Speaker of the House is skulking in the back of the room, and I just want to make sure everybody's well aware. Mr. Speaker? Come into the light where we can keep an eye on you. You know what? For 6 years, you always have it. Just about everybody at this table. It's an excellent point that you make, Representative Herron. Representative Grunberg?
What I was trying to respond to the angel's advocate on behalf of myself, I would have no problem and will have no problem if this goes before the voters and advocating for it, because it keeps our district small and it allows us to keep in personal contact with our constituents. I think it's a voter-friendly amendment. And I would make that argument very forcefully, because it'll help keep me in contact, or whoever is my successor, in contact with our people just as much as it does you.
One final comment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for allowing that. Is that, you know, I understand that. I'm just, as an Angels advocate, you know, just bringing this out is, you know, I don't think we'll ever get to New Hampshire where the average House representative represents 314 people. We'll never get there. But, again, I'm just, that's one of my concerns about this. And but do I support the concept? You bet I do.
Well, I had lunch with, this is the chair, I had lunch with somebody at Olivia's fine Mexican restaurant today. And we talked about this piece of legislation, Representative Wilson, and ideally, if it didn't require such a significant remodel of the chambers, the notion that we had is, would it be interesting if you could keep the Senate at 20 and expand the House to 60 and give each senator three representatives? And that would certainly make the House the people's House. And the fiscal note would be a whopper. But the idea is certainly certainly out of the box and positive, I think, for the people of Alaska. So, as I say, this is a very tall hill to climb, but you certainly have the empathy of the chair, because I like when people have a voice. But you're talking to somebody who likes direct democracy, too. I'm not afraid of ballot initiatives, just the ones that are poorly written. So with that, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't know who to ask the question to, but probably to the sponsor. Every single person in the state, bar none, will continue to have one rep and one senator. That won't change. So representation doesn't change. Now, with regard to this huge district, this is huge. Mostly empty space. I understand what how sparsely populated the interior is. So actually, it will shrink a bit. It won't be half the size. It won't be the size of Texas. It'll be the size of California. Still huge beyond any ability to make a change. So long as we're still having every individual has one rep and one senator, and that doesn't change, I'm wondering why I would expect, and I expect the public won't be very happy about the fiscal note, because they're not happy with us anyway. You take the polls, and I don't know too many that say, you guys are swell.
I'm just speaking for myself. My guys like me.
they always like
jokes.
No, they always like the person they have. They don't like the rest of us.
I give them plenty of reason to. I talk bad about the other 39 members with great regularity. Not you, Representative Dahlstrom. Point well made, Representative Gatto. Are there very easy to philosophize on this bill? Are there other thoughts on it? Representative Wilson, we have the only people signed up to testify are Margaret Patton Walsh with the Department of Law, available for questions, and also Tam Cook with the Ledge Affairs, available for questions.
Mayor.
And we have Mayor Botello. Are there any questions, though, for the Department of Law or Ledge Affairs, Representative Grunberg?
Yes. What's the attorney's name?
Margaret Patton Walsh with the Department of Law, and Tam Cook with Ledge Affairs.
Okay, Ms. Patton Walsh. This.
Hello, I'm here.
Yes. This is Representative Grunberg. If this is put to the voters, before it could, it would be after it's passed, if the voters approve it, before it can be implemented, it would have to be pre-cleared by Department of Justice. When does the pre-clearance occur? Does it occur? It must occur after we pass the legislation. Does it occur before or after the voters approve it?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I believe that it would occur after it's been approved. Although we could prepare the paperwork that would be necessary for pre-clearance once it's on the ballot in anticipation of passage, so that the moment the voters have spoken in November, if they were to accept the amendment, we could file paperwork with the Department of Justice the following day, I would expect. And then you'd have a process of, they have a 30-day turnaround, which is their standard turnaround, so they've got 30 days either to ask for more information or to sort of not approve or approve. Actually, I'm sorry, it's 60 days, a 60-day turnaround. So then if we don't hear from them within 60 days, we can assume that they've approved it. So sort of no word is good word. Or they could ask for more information, and that then produces another 60 days. And given the November date, we'd be getting, it'd be tight, but I think it would be doable, especially if the Department of Justice was friendly to the amendment.
I see. To follow up, that's good. So it would be possible to implement for the 2012 elections.
Right. The redistricting process will begin early in 2011. I don't know that the Census Bureau has issued their anticipated data date, so that each state's data will be issued sort of from a period, I think it's in mid-January through April, and we don't know where we'll be. Last time they did it alphabetically, which put Alaska's data sort of early in January, and I believe we requested an extension to be ready. We're planning to be ready for an early January date this year, this time around. So if we had a mid-January data thing, then we would have 30 days for the board to develop plans, another 60 days of hearings for those plans. So we'd have an adoption of a plan in April. And I think that by that time, I mean, by the time the board is starting to work, we're going to want to know how many districts they're creating. So if the Department of Justice hears it gets a preclearance request on November, I don't remember what the date the election is this year, but let's say it's November the 5th, so they get a request on the 6th, 60 days from there, we're looking at early January, which would be right before we would get data from the Census Bureau. So as long as the DOJ preclears within that 60-day period, we should be fine. The redistricting board would then know how many districts it was creating when it got data from the Census Bureau.
Ms. Walsh, let me cut you off for a second. Just one more question, and we got to keep this short because we got other bills on the calendar.
This is very important, though, Representative Gruber.
Yeah. Are you aware of any other issue in Alaska that's going to have to be pre-cleared?
Other than the plan itself when it comes around, no. I mean, I don't think, as far as I know, there's nothing else in terms of changes that we're talking, that would affect redistricting other than this constitutional amendment. I'm not aware of anything else.
I was not limiting it to redistricting. Anything else on the plate that would have to be pre-cleared prior to either this election or the 2012 election? That you know?
If you could introduce yourself, Margaret, just so we help with our secretary, please.
I'm Margaret Payne Walsh from the Department of Law. Representative Grumberg, through the chair, I don't represent the Division of Elections, and so the Division of Elections may have some sorts of changes that would require preclearance, but the preclearance requests are independent. So I don't think that any other preclearance issues that we might have would affect this situation.
Thank you very much.
All right. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we thank you very much, Representative Wilson. We do have Mayor Botello, former Attorney General, in the back of the room. We're honored to have you here, Mr. Mayor. We also have available for questions, Carla Schofield is here with Ledge Affairs Agency, if necessary. Mr. Mayor, the floor is yours. If you introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bruce Botello. I serve currently as the mayor of the city and borough of Juneau, though I appear here in my private capacity. Mr. Chairman, you alluded to my time as Attorney General, both as Deputy Attorney General and Attorney General. I was fairly intensely involved with reapportionment, both for the 1990 plus plan, finally adopted in 1994, and again the plan in 2002. I testify today in support of HDR 38. I think what I'd like to do is perhaps go directly to comments or questions asked by Representatives Gatto and Heron of Representative Wilson. First, the observation that Representative Gatto made with respect to the one person, one vote. Since the Supreme Court in Baker v. Carr and subsequently in Reynolds v. Sims in 1964, interpreted the U.S. Constitution to say that there's one person, one vote. That has been the law of the land. So it does mean concretely for Alaska that whatever the size of this body, an Alaskan who lives in Anchorage is going to have a voice the same weight, no more nor less, than a person who lives in Aniak or Angoon, which brings us then to the nub of this constitutional amendment. Why change it, and who is there going to be to speak for it? And I think the message that I would impart to my fellow citizens is, and on which I would rely, and that is a fundamental sense of fairness. And that is, I think we intuitively know that all other things being equal, a person who represents a district that is compact in size, and we have districts, of course, that are only a few square miles in size, can communicate more effectively with one's constituents and perhaps represent them more adequately than someone who has to deal and represent a district that are as many 10,000 miles apart. My sense is that, and I think reflected again on the map, Representative Gatto certainly noted that we have wide spaces when we look at the largest Senate district in the nation. But those spaces have to be traversed, and that is the challenge. Without a change to the state constitution, the challenge that this next reapportionment board will have will be even greater, and I think it will exacerbate the geographic disparity that we see in the state. And I'll conclude by saying that if I would commend to you actually the resolution as it was initially proposed, I recognize that there are fiscal impacts, there are space impacts, but looking at a legislature that had a House body of 48, I think most nearly allows one to minimize the increase of the footprint for any given district. And second, I think most adequately preserves the symmetry in the Constitution, particularly with regard to supermajority votes, whether two-thirds or three-quarters. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We're very happy to have you before us. Representative Gatto?
Mr. Mayor, there certainly must be an optimum number, and I doubt that it's 48. It could be in the hundreds. If you really, if your testimony is directed at the best possible representation, then we should probably reflect New Hampshire and do the best we can under those circumstances. So did you choose 48 as the ideal number, or just because it was the first proposed number, and is that superior to the number that's currently in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, my sense is that the number comes at 48 most nearly, I think, replicates districts in geographic size as they are today, that is to say, the largest districts. I certainly agree with the sentiment that there is no one optimum number. The balance, and one left to you initially, is the expense, the space, versus and actually the functionality of the body versus the ability to provide better access between representatives and their constituents.
I should agree.
Well said. I'm with you. I like the idea. Are there other questions for Mayor Patel? Mayor Patel, we appreciate your coming before the committee. It's a privilege to have you before us.
I would have a question.
Yes, Representative Grover.
We don't really have anybody here from the Alaska Municipal League or the Association of Mayors or anything like that. Do you have any idea how other local governments would feel about this, or would you be able to find out?
Mr. Chairman, the only body that I know has extensively debated the issue is the Conference of Southeast Mayors, and it has adopted a resolution in support of...
We have that. Oh, well, we have from the Southeast Conference.
Yes.
Excellent. Mr. Mayor, we thank you very much for your time. Is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify? Any questions for Ledge Affairs, for Ledge Legal, for the Department of Law? Seeing, yes?
Yeah, I do.
Representative Gatto, who would you like to address your question to?
Carla.
Carla? Carla. So happy to see you.
Good afternoon.
You're doing a great job this year, keeping everything flowing. You're doing very good. You haven't suspended my food privileges in the lounge yet this year. I haven't fallen 90 days behind pay and been leaned as the chairman of judiciary yet. Carla, if you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, for the record, I'm Carla Schofield with the Legislative Affairs Agency.
Welcome. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Physical note has your name on it.
Through the chair, yes, it does.
Is there any part of your analysis that will cost the state money that is not included in the fiscal note?
Not that I'm aware of. This fiscal note was kind of our best judgment at this point. We know there will be renovation costs. We know that we'll have increased per diem costs and salary and staff. But it's a pretty good estimate, I think.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Gatto.
In particular, my question might be to LIOs, which I did not see addressed in the fiscal note. Would that not be an additional cost?
Through the chair, there is money in the contractual line item for increase in office space rent. We'd have to see how redistricting came out to see whether or not we would be increasing the Anchorage LIO or whether or not we would be making some of our smaller LIOs, or maybe there'd be a new place where we'd need an LIO. So it is included. We have included office space rent and also a position 2 part-time LIO officers, which would be session only.
If I may, where is it included? It's not on this page.
It's on in the personal services line item. Are the two, if it's the second page of the fiscal note, it talks about in personal services.
Came up with $1.9 million in personal services?
Right. Part of that is for the salaries and benefits for the legislators, and part of it is for the staff to the legislators, but also the LAA would need some more support staff. We would undoubtedly need another attorney, and then session only we would have in this fiscal note, we have 2 LIO officers, an enroller for legal, maybe a help desk technician. We'd have to see how the workload, and that's where we get to our 1.9.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking for office rent.
Okay, office rent is in the contractual line. And what's in the contractual line is increased money for allowance accounts, because each legislator gets an allowance account. And then we also have some connectivity costs for phones and wiring. But then we have increase in office space rent. And the word rent isn't after office space, but that's what that is referring to, and it's for either expanding our existing legislative information offices or establishing new offices. And until the redistricting plan is put forth, we wouldn't know where those impacts were exactly.
Okay, so that's $175,000.
Yes, it is. I believe so. Yes.
Yeah, that's what it says. Thank you.
Carly, you've done an excellent job. Thank you very much for coming before the committee. Are there other questions? Seeing none, we thank you very much. There's nobody else in the room. I'm going to close public testimony, bring the resolution back before the committee. Are there any amendments that are offered? Seeing no amendments, would somebody be interested in making a motion?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Herron.
Move CS for House Joint Resolution 38 State Affairs backs 323/R with individual recommendations. Any attached fiscal notes?
Thank you. Seeing no objection, Representative Wilson, it looks like your perfect string of wins in this committee is still intact. This is a lucky room for you. You're welcome. It was a pleasure. Nicely done. Good luck in finance. Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for joining. It's a privilege to have you here. All right. Next, we're going to go to House Bill 408. It's 2:25 in the afternoon. We're going to continue hearing this bill until 3 p.m. We're going to get an introduction from our good friend Ben Mulligan and Representative Stoltz's office, and then we're going to try and take as much public testimony as we can. My understanding is that this bill is going to require some work, and so we will take as much testimony as we can, and then kind of tweak on a little bit until we get a bill that is ready to come back before the Judiciary Committee is our objective, is my understanding. Ben Mulligan, it is a privilege to have such a good man as yourself before the committee. If you will offer us your thoughts, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Stoltz's office. I guess you have House Bill 408 in front of you because of a court decision, U.S. versus Caron, which is now being interpreted by the federal government restricting firearm possession. There are several bills, one in the other body and another one here, trying to address that issue. And we felt that this also, as Representative Stoltz and Representative Ramirez, to try to further that discussion. So they talked and we introduced House Bill 408. What House Bill 408 does to try to remedy that is that currently, even with the affirmative defense included in 1161-200B, we're still having issues as far as people retaining their rights to have their firearms. They're not. What we do in this bill is change it from an affirmative defense to a non-applicability provision. Let's see. And just to give some background on Caron, it's a section of U.S. Congress law or U.S. law that they're interpreting as unless it's an all or nothing. So if you have any type of restriction for carrying or possessing of firearms, you no longer retain that right under the federal government. But if it was clear once in this case, it's for felons that have served their time and they're no longer incarcerated.
Ben Mulligan?
Yes, sir.
You have a friend in the room.
Oh. No donuts today, though, sir.
Representative Stoltz, would you join? Ben, he's doing an excellent job, but... that. Representative Stoltz, what a privilege to have you. Ben is doing an excellent job, and I just thought it would double our power here.
That's the entire opinion.
Representative Grunberg? Representative Grunberg, question?
Last chain.
Representative Stoltz, welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Bill Stoltz, representative for House District 16, Chugiak Matsu. I'll just about 30 seconds, Mr. Chair.
Roger that.
Appreciate this bill coming forward, your committee taking it up. It's not a seemingly easy subject to comprehend. Wanted to have the committee's help with our staff and other people in developing a logical path for where people who have lost their right to own a gun to reestablish that as is suggested. Reestablishing voting rights, and I know the right to bear arms is a lot more defined right in the original Constitution as drafted, and certainly voting has evolved over a couple of centuries and a cherished right as well. I see. I know one of the advocacy groups, the ACLU, has endorsed the reestablishment of voting rights through a process, and I think this is a similar thing. It's not easy to do it, and it's certainly not always understood by the public, but we'll seek your help and with our collective staff to try to find a logical path where people can reestablish their rights. Talking to members from some of the rural areas of Alaska, there are circumstances where not being able to own a gun affects the essence of the way of life in some areas, forever disenfranchised. So it's not we're not talking in abstract here. There's some very tangible things that we can see, and this is not an easy issue to deal with. But I think it's worthy. I've gone over 30 seconds, but it's worthy of trying to find an approach that may or may not be able to do it in the remaining 40-odd days, but I appreciate that we've started the steps.
Well, it's a good dialogue to have. We're never afraid to have a conversation. Question I have for you, Representative Stolz, I'm looking for language in here that would create two classes of people, people that have lost their rights due to a felony conviction and those that had a felony conviction that involved weapons. And I don't see such a distinction in this bill. Is that a possible wall to erect? I mean, we spent a lot of time in this committee creating felons, sadly, which is one of the big concerns I have about having chaired this committee for 4 years. Is there a way to draw a distinction between those people who have run afoul of the law and those people who have run afoul of the law with weapons related convictions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm open to looking at any avenue. This is not an expert. I'm not a lawyer, and that's not an apology, but a statement of fact. And I don't. Presenting this as not an inviolate piece of legislation, but rather a starting point document, so we can explore those paths. So I think that can be part of a dialogue through this process.
Good. Well, I think that's an interesting Chinese wall to consider erecting.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg,
I'm not going to ask these gentlemen this question. This is a question for future witnesses. We've been given two cases. One is the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'm going to have to get the whole opinion. I plan to look at the
Aaron versus U.S.?
Yeah. And then the other is Alaska Court of Appeals decision. I'm going to ask, before we go, if any of the folks, either you guys or anybody else in the room or online, wants me to look at any other cases, please give me the citations so I can do so.
Very good. Let me give you a range of those folks from whom we are going to take testimony and those who are available to offer testimony. Doug Moody is available for questions with the Public Defender's Office. Our good friend, Lieutenant Rodney Dial, is available with the state troopers to answer questions. Brian Judy with the NRA has indicated that he would like to testify. Eric Stanley is calling from Kenai. He would like to testify. We have Richard Patterson from Barrow, Alaska, would like to testify. And then from Chugiak area is Jim Adams, Don Clark from the Palmer area, and then Wayne Ross from Anchorage would like to testify. And I assume that's Wayne Anthony Ross.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Particularly the attorneys, Mr. Ross, Mr. Judy, I see we have Ms. Carpinetti here. Anybody, I really would like, before we go, citations on anything else for me to look at.
Duly noted for those attorneys who can refer us to refer us otherwise. So to that end, I think what we're going to do is hear from the civilians first. Representative Heron, comment?
Mr. Chairman, to our friend, the co-chair of House Finance, not a lawyer is a badge of honor, sir.
For some. There's nothing wrong with attorneys. I promised Representative Holmes I wouldn't speak ill of him anymore. So with that, Representative Stolz, we're delighted to have you stay with us. We know how busy your schedule is. It's not necessary. Ben Mulligan was doing an exceptional job before he came in the room.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what I'd add except for less space.
Entertainment value. You provide considerable entertainment value, Representative Stolz. And if you'd like, Representative Stolz, as a courtesy, we could go talk to Jim Adams from Chugiak first, if you'd like.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't ask anybody to testify in person, but
he's from your hometown.
He's from one of my favorite places.
Indeed. So why don't we go to Jim Adams with Chugiak first? Jim, are you with us?
Paul, this is Jim Adams here.
Did
you hear me?
Yeah, if you'll introduce yourself for the record and any affiliations that you have, Jim.
What's that? Introduce yourself. Okay. Yeah, this is Jim Adams here, and
represent yourself.
I represent myself. Yes.
Damn right, okay. You do.
I don't hear good, so I'm trying to catch what you asked me.
Yes, sir.
Basically, my conviction was in '85 in June 5th, and the judge waived the anti-gun things for me, and I got probation 5 years, and then I applied for and got a federal firearms license after a conviction in March 86, and then I got my federal firearms license on July 1st of 86. I went to two gunsmithing schools between 86 and 89. One was in Pine City, Minnesota, and the other in Rogue Community College in Grants Pass, Oregon. And then I came back to Alaska. I had originally come to Alaska in 64, and I was living here again from 64 to 67, and then from 81 to 84, and then from 90 to the present time. And I had my federal firearms license up here, too. So I had my federal firearms license from 86, July 1st, till 2001, July 1st, it would have expired. However, that other law that came in 98 there kind of changed things for me. And so they asked me to hand over my federal firearms license because now I wasn't allowed to own handguns by the state of Alaska. I could own rifles and shotguns, but I could not own handguns. And then the feds said I could own everything or nothing because of the way the law works. And so now I'm not even allowed to purchase a handgun, rifle, or a shotgun on my own name. Now, I've never had any run-ins with the law previous to my conviction in 85, and I've never had any run-ins with the law since then. I've had a clean record. I was born in 45, and I'm going on 65 years old now. And in a few years, I'll be, you know, going on 70, and I'd like to be able to legally go out and shoot and enjoy guns and reload and maybe do some gunsmithing legally. And I had driven truck for several years and injured my arm, and I'm not allowed to work no more that way because of my injury. And so I was going to fall back on the training I had from gunsmithing school and machinist school and do these things in my retirement because I have a very small Social Security. And my wife and myself are living alone now. We've got, we had 9 kids who grew up, and we've got 17 grandkids and a great-grandchild. And I'm not a threat to anybody. I'm not planning on breaking any laws. I just like guns, and I've learned how to work. I went to school for it, and I enjoy being able to do this now as I'm getting older and not going, I can't even go really legally shooting or anything the way the statutes are now. I might add that I lost FFL through no fault of my own, and I might add it wasn't easy to get the FFL in the first place with a conviction. And also, I did get the, like I said before, the restoration of firearms privileges in a letter from the Department of Treasury on March 11th of 86, and that wasn't easy to get either. So I worked hard towards getting these things, and now they were taken through no fault of my own at this point, you see. And I would like that to be straightened out so I'd be able to enjoy my hobby and also might be able to make some money on the gunsmithing on the side, which I could use extra money for myself and my wife. And that's probably about all I have to say.
Jim, I appreciate your testimony very much. Representative Stoltz, any remarks?
No, nice to hear from you, Mr. Adams, and certainly I don't think I've met you, but when I get back home, feel free to stop in and visit.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Adams, thank you very much for your compelling and candid testimony. And Representative Stoltz, we're happy to have you here, but if you've got other things to do, we're in able shape. We trust Ben Mulligan immensely. He's a great representative for the building, your office, and for the public servants across Alaska.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I'd like to echo what you just said to the last witness. I found that case very compelling.
Yes.
And I'm glad you led off with him because that's the kind of evidence we need. We're trying to do the right thing and to do some justice here. And I think
well
he's
said,
the person
Representative
that
Grunberg.
Really deserves of our
Well said. And so in that spirit, I think we're going to save the attorneys for last. We're going to go to Eric Stanley in the Kenai. Mr. Stanley, are you with us?
Representative Stoltz. Yes, sir.
Go ahead. If you'll introduce yourself, any affiliations you have for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Eric Stanley, and I'm here representing myself. I'm here today in hopes that someday I, as well as the state of Alaska, will have our rights restored. I'm here to give my testimony in favor of this bill. As an Alaskan for over 20 years, I've grown to love and become an avid outdoorsman. I've found myself in numerous wildlife situations over the years that caused me to, you know, in some instances, be in fear for my life as well as the life of my loved ones. There isn't much bear control down on the Kenai Peninsula here, the surrounding areas. I've experienced over the years more and more brown bear encounters as populations continue to boom. Up to this point, I've been lucky, but at some point I feel that my luck may run out. I'm an average Joe that has paid his debt to society and been pardoned under suspended and imposition of sentence, also fulfilling all the obligations and terms and conditions of my probation. Should I have the right to protect my own life is kind of a question that I ask myself sometimes. Fishing is not only a great way to have fun and enjoy time with friends and family, it's also a huge part of my life and the lives of my loved ones. In some cases, it's even put food on the table more than once. And because of the bear population and my inability to carry a gun, I've had to stop taking my daughter fishing. I feel I've paid my debt to society. To not be able to spend quality time fishing with my daughter because of my fear of her potentially losing her life in a bear attack or a mauling hits me pretty hard personally. I received theft in the second by receiving stolen property back when I was a kid around the age of 19 or 20. I am now 33, going on 34 in June of this year. Not only did I do my time and serve my probation, I received suspended imposition of sentence. And to my recollection, because this was some time ago, it's been around or over 10 years. My daughter is 13 years old and the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm doing my best to be a single parent and keep her goal-orientated and out of trouble, hoping that, you know, she won't follow in some of the footsteps I did in the past. One-on-one family time, sports, academics seem to be a good place to start. Camping, fishing, hiking, mountain biking are just some of the things that I feel that we're missing out on as a family. I refuse to put Alexa in a situation where I can't protect her. I have no desire to break the law and carry a gun unlawfully, so what choices or rights do I have? I feel as if my right to spend quality time with my family has somewhat been encroached on also. If I can't protect her, then we lose out on the things we love to do. To this day, I have never had the opportunity to take her hunting, and I fear that that day may never come. It is my hope that someday my rights will be restored, as well as the rights of many others like me. To miss out on these opportunities would be a tragedy in my eyes. However, for myself, I fear it's a matter of time and we're a life and death type situation, because fishing for me just isn't something that I'm willing to give up. It's a huge part of my life. I grew up out in the Aleutians, out in Dutch Harbor, and as a kid, it's just been a huge part of my life for as far back as I can remember. I fear it's a matter of time before I find myself in a bear encounter that I can't get out of without the right to defend myself. And not to be out of line, and with all due respect, during the first teleconference, I was kind of present and listening in on it, and the words were used, another bullet in the gun. Is kind of a metaphor to describe the protection of small business owners in Fairbanks. In the situation that some of us find ourselves in as outdoorsmen, we don't have the ability to have the bullet or the gun to defend ourselves. And that pretty much concludes my testimony.
Eric, thank you very much for your compelling testimony. And you illustrate exactly the concern that I have, which is drawing a division between those that have committed a felon with a weapon and those who committed a felon without a weapon. And I gather from the conviction that you had, there was no weapons charge involved. Is that correct?
You know, sir, when I was a kid, I had a fascination with firearms. The theft in the second was involving a stolen weapon, but, you know, at the time, I did not know that. And being a young, ignorant individual, I just made some poor choices.
Understood, but just for clarification, did you use the weapon in the process of committing a crime, or that was the charge, was for accepting a stolen weapon?
Correct, sir.
Would you say that...
Accepting a stolen weapon.
So you didn't use a weapon in the commission of a crime?
No, sir.
Right, roger that. That's what I was looking for. We appreciate your testimony, and Eric, it takes a fair amount of courage, you know, to kind of man up and tell your story, and to lead, on behalf of your community when it involves really kind of bearing your soul to a room full of people that you can't see. And I admire you for the courage, and would tell you this is the way. This is the way that you change laws and you change policy in the state of Alaska. So I see other members of the committee nodding their head. We appreciate you for offering us your compelling and very candid testimony. Thank you for taking time out of your day.
Thank you, sir.
And your daughter's got a heck of a role model, and she's fortunate to have you. We appreciate your humility.
I appreciate that.
Yes.
May I inquire?
Representative Gruenberg has a question for you, Eric.
Eric, where do you live?
Currently residing in the peninsula. I've relocated because of...
Well, I don't need to go into the details. Do you live in a town or out in the countryside?
In Soldana, sir.
Okay.
In the town.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Eric. Next, we're going to go to Richard Patterson in Barrow. Richard, are you with us?
Yes, sir. This is Richard Patterson. I live in Barrow, but I'm actually in Kotzebue right now.
Hey, I love Kotzebue. How's it going in Kotzebue?
Very good, sir. Sunny, about 16 below. It's very nice.
Have you seen Dean Westlake today? Is he around town?
I'm unable to answer that, sir. I would like to thank the committee to allow me to talk today. It's an honor and a pleasure.
You're welcome.
I'm a 55-year-old Alaskan pilot. I've been flying in the bush for over 30 years. The last 15, I've been engaged in full-time medevac and search and rescue operations, encompassing both the North Slope and the Northwest Arctic Burrow. I serve and protect over 20 communities and hundreds of thousands of square miles. I have many stories, some tragic, some glorious. A firearm is a tool that I must have in my profession, and I thank the legislative body for seeing this need and applying restorative legal avenues for those of us with felony convictions. I erred my ways years ago. I saw what was wrong. I corrected it. I went on. My wife is from Kotzebue. We have two sons. Both of them are at UAF right now. My success story is from hard work, dedication, loyalty to the people of Alaska and those that I serve. I'm on the front lines of all that is harms bush residents. I have directly participated in the saving of thousands of lives. I fly jets, turboprops, and helicopters year-round. I have made exemplary rehabilitative efforts and also done extraordinary acts, of which have been recognized by a duly elected executive officer of our great state. I was granted a full unconditional pardon. It states in my pardon that its main purpose is so that I may have handguns to protect others. I have many stories, as I said. A lot of them involve wildlife. Everything from dispatching man-eating grizzly bears from our helicopter to fending off dual grizzly bears attacking me and my passengers in an aircraft accident. I've been stalked by bears. I've looked out my living room window, and I raised two children there with bears oftentimes right outside. A firearm is not a luxury. It is an absolute necessity for survival in the bush. There are many others like me that need to have the avenue of a restorative way to get their rights back. Felons are not a cast of people that need to be thrown away and deemed worthless, that their lives cannot be protected. I stand in full support of 408. However, it must be modified in the removal of subpart alpha 12, as was eloquently stated. Unless all rights are restored in firearm possession, no rights will be restored. So therefore, the federal government is intervening in the rights and the due knowledge and wisdom of our state legislators. Also, the power to pardon is in the executive branch alone. My pardon is full and complete. Legislative instruments that delude or usurp the power of that pardon are a clear violation of the separation of powers intrinsic to our form of government.
Mr. Patterson, we've got other people that need to testify. We only have 8 minutes left. Can you wind up your testimony, please?
Yes, sir. I hope dearly that you can rectify the inadequacies in this bill. I thank you for bringing it forward. It is justice. Justice denied one is justice denied many. And thank you for your time so much. It is a tremendous honor to be here.
Thank you. The privilege is ours. Representative Grimberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Patterson and the other folks who have testified and are going to testify, this bill goes beyond just the restorative right to bear arms. It touches on something that affects a number of my constituents in the Mountain View Russian Jack area, and something that I have neglected my duty because I have not pursued, but I intend to do as a result of this bill. We need to look and see the folks who have rehabilitated themselves and make certain that their civil rights are fully restored as appropriate, including the right to bear arms, the right to vote, the right to contract, anything else. As long as the public is protected and they have rehabilitated themselves, and you gentlemen have reminded me that we need to look out in a broader sense for people in your positions. Thank you.
Mr. Patterson, I will echo that sentiment. Your testimony is compelling, and if we weren't short on time, we would have had more of it. Representative Lynn, question? No question. So we thank you, Mr. Patterson. Next, we're going to go to Don Clark in Palmer. Mr. Clark, we'll ask you to be brief because we would like to get some comments from Brian Judy and from Wayne Anthony Ross. So Don Clark, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
If you'll introduce yourself and any affiliation you have for the record, please.
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Committee. My name is Don Clark. I live in Palmer. I've lived in Alaska for 25 years. I'm 64 years old. I've got two grown children and two grandchildren. I own a handyman construction company, and I also build furniture. I've never had a blemish on my record until about 10 years ago. I was living with a lady friend who asked me if I could grow a few plants for her, and not thinking clearly at the time, I said, sure. Well, needless to say, it was not a good idea. My lawyer explained to me the deal the DA was offering, and if I pled guilty, I would get a fine, 2 years probation, and SIS, and if I completed all the conditions set forth by the court, my record would be wiped clean, and I would get all my rights back. All of this happened except when I tried to purchase a new shotgun, I was declined by the federal government. It seems the state law and the federal law were not interpreted the same way. And in turn, I also had not gotten all my rights back. I tried every avenue I could and filled out all the paperwork possible, but nothing was enough for the federal government. And I went to Wayne to see if he could help me, and this is where we're at now. I just feel the state failed me by telling me I'd get all my rights back when it wasn't true. This is Alaska, and hunting is a way of life. And even when fishing, a firearm is not a luxury, but a necessity, both for peace of mind and for protection if the need arises. I feel the law needs to be changed to correct this oversight. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clark. I don't see any questions around the table. We thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'd like to go to one of the most colorful characters in the state of Alaska. I was happy to move you from my committee, and I voted for you. Representative Lynn thinks it's him. But I was happy to vote for you on the floor. Wayne Anthony Ross, are you with us?
I'm there.
If you'll introduce yourself for the record.
I'm
appreciate you taking me. I have to go to court in about 20 minutes. The situation is this. The legislature passed certain laws that restored rights to felons, the rights immediately after they were discharged from probation to buy shotguns and rifles, and after 10 years after they were off probation to own concealable firearms. You had a couple caveats. One, they couldn't carry concealed except on their own property, or they couldn't carry concealed about the streets, but they could carry if they're engaged in lawful outdoor activities such as hunting and fishing. The problem is that the federal government under this Carone case, and for the benefit of Representative Grunberg, the citation is 524 U.S. 308, 1998 case. Supreme Court said basically if there's any restrictions on a person's right to own guns, they can't buy or possess any type of firearm whatsoever. So in effect, the federal government is changing the law that the good legislature attempted to impose. They're in effect interfering with our efforts in the state of Alaska to restore some of the rights to our citizens who have gone through the process and paid their debt to society. Some of the people you testified to that I represent, one has a presidential pardon, several have governor's pardons, several have had their rights restored by the federal government, but they can't get a concealed carry license under Alaska because they were at one time convicted of a felony, and that's another restriction that causes the feds to say they can't own any guns at all. So it's kind of a strange situation, but this bill might have to be fine-tuned somewhat, but it, I think it stands up for states' rights and gives Alaskans the rights that the legislature tried to impose by previous laws. We have people that subsistence hunt that can't do it. We have people that travel in the bush that can't carry a firearm. And it's long overdue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. And Mr. Ross, a quick question for you. Do you think that we should draw a distinction between those who used a weapon to commit a felony and those who did not?
Yes, I think you have already done that in your previous legislation that was passed. What you want to do is, of course, prevent people who have violent felonies in their background, perhaps from owning a firearm in the future. But none of these people that have testified here today have that type of crime.
Mr. Ross, we thank you for your testimony. I wish you good health, and you're a legendary Alaskan. Whether you love Wayne Anthony Ross or not, you're a one-off. You're one of a kind. Representative Grunberg.
I came down here, and I didn't get any ice cream. I understand you get ice cream at Fairbanks, but I didn't get any here.
Only if you offer a good testimony, Mr. Ross. Representative Grunberg has a question for you.
Wayne, this is Max. I'm embarrassed to be talking to you like this. I owe you a letter I haven't forgotten. I will write.
No problem.
Yeah, and I'll send the ice cream, Mr. Ross. So we thank you for your testimony today. Good to hear from you. Glad you're healthy and well.
Thank you.
And finally today, we're going to go to Brian Judy and then questions for Lieutenant Rodney Dial, if anybody has questions. Brian, you've heard the testimony today. It's been quite compelling on this Judiciary Committee. Would you care to offer us your thoughts in summary? We are pressed against the 3 o'clock hour, so as brief as you can be, we'd be appreciative.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is Brian Judy. I am the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association, and my clock says it's 3 o'clock, so I don't know how much time I have, but this is a very complicated issue. The solution is fairly simple. I have provided some fairly detailed technical background information on what exactly has the state of Alaska in this situation. I mean, it would take me some time to go through that. I'll try to summarize and address a question that's been raised.
Hey, Brian?
Brian?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me? Representative Grunberg is gesturing to me that he would prefer actually to hear the long form of your remarks. And so if you could give us some, perhaps some of the highlights, and then what we would like to do is, if you can give us a general direction of how you would like to see this bill shaped, then we will work on it, and then when we come back, we will invite you to provide a longer form testimony for the record and for the benefit of the committee. So could you give us some highlights? We're going to work on this bill before we take it up as a bill previously heard. So if you have some thoughts as to how we might fine-tune or reshape this bill, it would be helpful. I'm going to have Representative Gruenberg pose his question to you, and maybe you can respond to that.
Brian, this is Max. I support the bill. I want to help it. And I don't know that we need to hear a lot from you today. I really want to put on the record your concerns. I don't want us to be rushed up against it, and I'll be happy to work with you and Ben and everyone else on this Department of Law, et cetera. But I don't want you to feel rushed.
So you're asking, what do you want to hear from him, Representative Gruenberg?
Nothing today. I'd rather that we can get out and we can talk on the phone. I'm sure that Ben will set that up and we can all talk and Jane and get this squared away and really take his testimony later. I don't need to hear anything today.
Okay. Brian, your call. Do you want to offer some highlights or would you rather stand by for when we can hear from you in a long form?
Well, Mr. Chairman, do you want me to briefly give you a suggestion on the NRA's read on what needs to be done?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Here's the problem. Alaska state law already restores rights to former offenders. You've heard about the Karen decision and the all-or-nothing test that must be applied, and the bottom line is that unless a state restores 100% of a person's rights and treats that person like any other law-abiding citizen who never lost rights, then for the purpose of federal law, that person has no rights. Well, Alaska restores roughly 95% of the rights. You can possess long guns, you can possess handguns, you can carry handguns openly, and you can carry handguns concealed, but only in limited circumstances. So there's a provision. Oh, and let me also answer your question about the distinction in classes. That's already the case in law. There's a prohibition for carrying firearms that are capable of being concealed, you know, essentially handguns. And then there's a separate prohibition for concealed carry of a handgun. Now, for both of those are both in 1161-200. That's misconduct involving weapons in the third degree. And for both of those separate prohibitions, there are affirmative defenses. Now, the affirmative defense for carrying a concealed handgun is basically restoration of rights and also a limitation on carry. Here's what you need to do. You need to repeal 1161-200G... 2. You need to repeal the limitations on concealed carry. And then what you also need to do is you need to change the affirmative defenses, and that would be 1161-200B and 1161-200G. You need to change those from affirmative defenses to exceptions. And if you do that, then you have in effect completely restored the rights of people who are deserving, and the deal with the affirmative defense is if a person who's had his rights restored can be arrested and charged with a crime and then raise an affirmative defense, he's not treated the same as a person who's never lost his rights and who can't be charged with that crime in the first place. So with respect to the different classes, if you look in 1161-200, in B, which is the affirmative defense for the first prohibition, gosh, this is, I apologize, I know this gets really confusing.
You hear from this later.
But suffice it to say that there already is a distinction between felons who've had their rights restored and the felony was not a crime against the person and felons who did have a crime against another person. And And those people who did violate Alaska Statutes 11.41, who committed a crime against another person, they can't get their rights back. So,
hey Brian,
they are not.
Brian, it's helpful, but I think we're gonna wind it up for today. You've given us enough of a rabbit trail. We're gonna work on it. We will work with you offline. Representative Gruenberg has a final question for you.
Mr. Judy, it would help me if you could take a copy of HB 408 and just mark it up in pen and ink, what you like about it and what changes you'd like to see, and if you could get that to Ben, and then Ben will distribute it to us, and that way you have one point of contact. But I'd like to see a marked up version of 408. If you can get that should be online, and if Ben, if you would make that happen.
If not, I can email it to him.
Thanks.
All right, and that was Ben Mulligan that would help you. And Brian, you know, you're well aware we're in the second year of a 90-day session. Today is day 54, so we would like to bring this back up as the bills previously heard ASAP so that we can move it and get it in the queue for the Finance Committee and try and get it to the floor and see whether there is an appetite in the legislature to address this bill before we come to an end of the session. So we look forward and appreciate your help.
My pleasure, and I will make myself available as necessary.
Thank you, Brian. And finally, are there any questions for Lieutenant Rodney Dial? I don't see any here. We appreciate you listening in, Lieutenant Dial. It's 3:10, and we are adjourned. Ben, thanks for your help.